Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. And we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Happy Thursday. So glad you tuned in today. Well, here's a question for you. What do you know about your own soul? If someone were to ask you, what's the condition of your soul? What would you say? Do you think it's possible to live with a healed and a whole soul? And do you believe that real life transformation is possible? Well, my guest today is Dr. Kurt Thompson. I love it when he joins us. And we're talking about an old book of his that feels so new to me. I can't even believe it. Just looks now. It looks new. It's, I think he said, a decade old. Dr. Kurt Thompson talks about his book, Anatomy of the Soul, Surprising Connections Between Neuroscience and Spiritual Practices That Can Transform Your Life and Relationships. Just the mind-body connection, the way that God has wired us, the way God has equipped us to be whole, to be healed, and so much depends on us paying attention to the information that we gather from our emotions, from our rogue thoughts, even from the traumas and memories of our past. What do we do with those things, and what kind of story do we tell ourselves? We'll talk about how the brain works and what the Lord wants for you and me. I can't wait for you to hear what Dr. Kurt Thompson has to say. A couple quick announcements before we get Dr. Kurt on the show. Our ministry spotlight this month is Reach Beyond, and this is our spotlight partner. We love them. They're motivated to see the fulfillment of Jesus' command to make disciples, making him known in every nation, tribe, and tongue. You can learn more and even get involved. Check it out at myfaithradio.com. Also, each week of this month, we're giving away an awesome, amazing Bible. It's called the Financial Stewardship Bible. It's put together in collaboration with Howard Dayton from MoneyWise. This Bible features over 2,000 highlighted verses that talk about God's perspective on stewardship, provision, finances, faith, those kinds of things. All you got to do is sign up to win. So hop on our website at myfaithradio.com. Okay, think about this again. When you think of soul wholeness and healing, you also need to think about people in your life who love you, who look you in the eye, who listen to you, who are there for you. Because you know what? God uses these people in our lives as catalysts of healing for our own lives. My guest today writes this: when a person tells his or her story and is truly heard and understood, both he or she, and the listener undergo actual changes in their brain circuitry. So I want you to picture that. When somebody's listening to you, or you're listening to somebody else, and you've got empathy, and you're taking in the story, something changes in both people, the person who's listening, the person who's speaking. Dr. Thompson says they feel a greater sense of emotional relational connection, decreased anxiety, greater awareness of and compassion for others' sufferings. Let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Dr. Kurt Thompson is a psychiatrist in private practice in Falls Church, Virginia. He's also the founder of Center for Being Known, a nonprofit organization that develops resources to educate and train leaders with the fields of mental health, education, business, and the church about the intersection between interpersonal neurobiology and Christian spiritual formation. This is so fascinating to me. He and his wife, Phyllis, a licensed clinical social worker, are parents of two children, and they reside in Arlington, Virginia. Dr. Kurt, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Susie. It's such a pleasure to be back with you.
I always love our conversations, Dr. Kurt. And I'm wondering, we love to start every day talking scripture, and I know you're somebody who loves God's word. So is there a verse you've been thinking about these days, or maybe a life verse that you sort of carry with you, you can share with us?
Well, you know, it's it never ceases to be the case that I would say two things. One is, this notion that I myself personally am still, you know, as U2 says, I still haven't found what I'm looking for, right? Mm-hmm. I'm still searching to know that I know that I know things. And I keep bumping up against God's invitation, rather, not that knowing things is unimportant, but that in the end, being known by God is that much more important than all the things that I can collectively know. And so I still think about St. Paul's words when he writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 that there are those who believe they know who don't know as they ought, but the person who loves God is known by God. And I have to admit that there are still parts of me that I'm probably a little afraid of revealing to him, certainly revealing to others to be known, but by which, you know, he's still waiting to regenerate those.
Hmm.
And then, that's one thing. And then I also recently have been really struck by the fourth verse of the 27th Psalm, where the writer says, in essence, there's one thing that I've asked, to be able to dwell in your house and to behold your beauty and to see your face. This notion of dwelling in the house of God, and if we think about how that temple in the Old Testament, then in the New Testament Gospels, we see how Jesus basically says, look, I am the temple. And then further into the New Testament after Pentecost, we see how Jesus says, if we are Jesus' body, then we become the collective temple. This notion that to behold the face of God and to be and to behold his beauty, really, like in one way to think about that is about being in the presence of others and allowing others to be in the presence of us so that we behold God's presence. We behold his beauty by beholding the beauty of others. And ironically, that also includes beholding the parts of them and of us that at first glance we might not think are all that attractive, but that God has certainly come to redeem. So those are a couple of biblical passages that are kind of, you know, trying to do their work on me in the last few weeks, in the last few months.
I love that. I love the way that you say they're doing their work on you. Been thinking so much, Dr. Kurt, lately, just about, again, God's patience with us, the things he sees in our character that we don't even see. And yet it doesn't keep him from holding back his grace and his mercy, even his affection towards us. I mean, you know, we can get to places of self-contempt when we start to see things, but it's not new news to him. And he's been loving us all along. I mean, it's a marvel, isn't it?
Right. It is a marvel. And, you know, it's interesting, Susie, in that it is so reflective of the way the brain actually works. It's so reflective of how our neural networks tend to progress. So, for instance, if it were up to me, I would much more prefer that God would act like a surgeon. You know, he could give me anesthesia, put me to sleep, do some kind of spiritual surgical procedure on me, wake me up 3 or 4 hours later, and I would be fully transformed. Instead, he seems to behave much more like a rehab specialist where, you know, he has me fully conscious and we are going to work this spiritual joint or this muscle group and we are going to continue to work this no matter how long this takes because there is a seriousness with which he takes this entire process. Now, as far as neuroscience is concerned, one of the things that I think is reflected in that is that if you were to cut a nerve that would be close to the end of your finger, it would take that nerve about a month to grow a millimeter. So it would take, you know, if you cut your fingers, you know, 6 months from six millimeters from the end of your finger, it would probably take about 6 months before you would get full feeling back to the tip of your finger. And the thing is that the neurons are able to grow, but they do tend to grow slowly. Now, the more neurons we have involved, the more effective work we can attribute to that growth. The point being that even though because there is renewal of these neurons that is taking place with the renewal of our mind, it still takes time for that to happen. And here's the good news: Jesus is not worried about the way he has made us. He's not worried about the fact that these changes take time, but that they are most certainly taking place with greater permanence, and we see this now that when it comes to our character change by the practices that we employ, by sharing our hearts through confession with other people and so forth, when we do that, those changes become substantial and become durable, literally, in the neural network changes in our brain.
Boy, you just explained why it's so important that we be as Christ to each other. Because comparing, you know, the surgeon, you know, I agree with you. How great it would be put under anesthesia, cut out the icky parts of my, you know, personality and character. Let me wake up and feel better. But you're so right. He's more like a rehab doctor that walks the process through and puts up with our groaning and complaining and denying. But he's in it with us. And you think about, yes, for us to heal in community, then somehow we have to be that way for each other. But Dr. Kurt, we want to fix each other. I want you to be fixed now. And you want, you know what I'm saying? And we have a grace deficit for each other, especially for people who maybe think differently than we do. Lord, help us, you know?
Yes. Well, and not least of which being, you know, often our children, right? My wife and I are now the parents of adult children. And you know, you think that you raise your kids and you send them off to adulthood, and you'd like to think that you're done, but of course you get surprised, right? Mm-hmm. Because now you're doing things that you used to do only with adults, and there is that sense of, you know, wondering how long is this going to take. And of course, most of my problem, as it turns out, is not with my children; it is with the things that my interactions with them and with others evoke in me and reveal about my own impatience, about my own lack of growth, about my own character flaws and so forth. And part of why I want to fix someone else when I encounter their challenges is because those challenges that they have evoke things within me about my own story, about my own unfinished business, that I would much rather not really have to take a look at, but that God is surely going to use that presence of another person to reveal to me the work that he still so lovingly wants to transform.
Hmm. Wow, he's amazing God. So glad to have Dr. Kurt Thompson on the show today, talking about his book, Anatomy of the Soul, Surprising Connections Between Neuroscience and Spiritual Practices That Can Transform Your Life and Your Relationships. We're going to talk about the anatomy of the soul and how this thing all connects. We are so fearfully and wonderfully made. We can't even imagine it. I have exactly one copy to give away. I wish I had more, but I got one. So email if you want in on the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget your mailing address. If you've got a question for Dr. Kurt, you can include that as well. But we've got more great conversation up ahead. Don't go away. Back in a minute. Place where fear has to face the God you know. Wow, I love that. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is The Promise, having a really important conversation about the anatomy of your soul. You are so fearfully and wonderfully made. God made no mistakes when he made you, and he knows that you and I were all a pile of contradictions. You know, we're grateful and we're grumpy. We're selfish and unselfish. We're full of faith and full of fear the next moment. And he's invested in us. He's with us on this journey. So honored to be talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson today. We've had him on the show before. This book is titled Anatomy of the Soul, Surprising Connections Between Neuroscience and Spiritual Practices That Can Transform Your Life and Relationships. And you open the book, if you don't mind, Dr. Kurt, talking about this. You tell the story about your response to your mom's last days. I was gripped when I was reading this story, and I love your honesty, your transparency in this story. Tell it if you would.
Well, my mom, you know, she passed away now about 13 years ago at age 86. And just prior to her passing, she had developed some medical complications that it appeared that she could have done something about, but elected not to. And those medical complications eventually led to her demise. It was ironic that while all that was going on, I happened to be at a conference in New York City in which I was hearing my now friend and colleague Dan Siegel for the first time. And it was while at that conference that I got a phone call from my brother that indicated that our mom wasn't doing well, and just alerting me to that. And as I came home and then made the journey to Ohio to visit with her, in what became the beginning of her last days, some of the things that we were learning about in this initial exposure to interpersonal neurobiology really began to ring true with me. And I had grown up in a family in which my relationship with my mom, though very loving and very kind, also was fraught with my kind of being someone who helped her regulate her anxiety. No family is perfect, and ours was no different. And one of the roles that I played was to be a bit of a sounding board for her in the midst of times for her that were challenging or anxiety-provoking. And I think that that was something that probably created no small amount of resentment within me, even though I also, was a pretty good soldier in my family and was not going to express that very easily. And I think that at the time that I came to her bedside then, after really pondering some of these things that we were learning about the role of how what happens when you retell your story to someone who's empathically listening, how that changes not only the story that you hear them telling, but also has the effect of being able to change your own story. And so as I sat at her bedside, I invited her to once again tell me some things about her story.
Let's pause here, though, Dr. Kurt, if you don't mind, because the backstory a little bit, if it's okay to interject, was your wife noticing you feeling a little bit irritable around your mom's, passing, her potential passing, and your wife kind of insightfully said that you're reacting in a different way than I would think that you would. And you started to take what you just learned from the conference and ponder what your wife said, and then you went to talk to your mom from a different place. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually true. Thanks for that reminder. It is true that I was actually, I remember feeling that I had these various feelings between, a certain degree of sadness that she was dying, but also a certain coldness, a certain kind of distance from it. And I think a lot of that was protecting me from my own feelings of kind of disappointment and anger. And my wife noticed this, that for, in the face of this news that my mom might be dying, I wasn't really exhibiting much compassion. I wasn't really exhibiting much patience or empathy for my mom. And my wife picked up on this and said, excuse me, but what's going on? What's that about? And that's when I began to, it really struck me. I mean, it was helpful to have my wife asking me these questions about, where is this response in you coming from? And it was in that, it was in the spirit of that I thought, I really need to hear my mom's story, perhaps for the first time in a way that I'm not going to be listening to it as a little boy who's trying to help regulate his mom in order to help regulate himself, but someone who's an adult who could actually be compassionate with that. And as I sat at her bedside and asked her to tell me again some things about her life, Susie, I discovered that there, what I was hearing was not the story of a woman who was just anxious. I was hearing a story of an orphan who, as it turns out, she'd been. I was hearing a story of a little girl who'd been abandoned. I was hearing the story of a girl who'd lost her mother at age 3 and whose father had kind of shipped her off because he wasn't able to take care of her. And for the first time, I was finding myself feeling compassion for her. But I think simultaneously, and this is the thing that really caught me off guard, I also found myself feeling actually a certain degree of compassion for myself. I mean, feeling like, because all these years I'm thinking like, well, my mom could do better, my mom should know better, and so forth. And I then found myself feeling like, my goodness, I'm also someone who has been raised by a person who's doing the best she could, not someone who intentionally was foisting her anxiety upon him. And so this also began to change my own sense of my own story. Because I had grown up as someone who, found myself working really hard very frequently to try to make sure that I didn't make any mistakes and, trying to regulate my mom's anxiety. And when I didn't do that very well, it was easy for me to be pretty self-critical about that. And in this was some of the first wave of my beginning to retell and re-understand my story as it turns out, a young guy whose mom was doing the best she could, but who didn't then need to understand his role as someone who needed to take care of her, and whose own feelings of not being understood very well were completely now understandable, but not because his mother didn't care about him, but because she was really doing the best she could.
It's so interesting. You said that your mom's apathy had activated your own sense of inadequacy. And in fact, earlier you write, "How dare my mother give up? How dare she be so passive as she sometimes was," which reinforced the distressing emotional undercurrents that ran through our family. We were skilled at maintaining an illusion that we were well. In fact, we were in some respects rather ill. So then you said, you know, her apathy now as for you as an adult activated that sense of inadequacy from when you were young. And yet as you entered into her story and heard it with an adult heart and mind and had a front row seat, I almost wept with you. You just said you sobbed, you had this empathy, and you felt a physiological change in your own body. And I thought this was so interesting. You said for the longest time you'd felt that if your mom wanted to, she could have at any time chosen a path of like engagement and courage instead of operating in passivity and fear. And that was so good for me to hear, Dr. Curt. We probably got about 2.5 minutes left. But when you're not a passive person, I mean, I have an aversion to passivity. I just see it as a parasite, and I think it passes for meekness and humility and in the church, and it's just not. But to read that and go, well, that's if someone's passive, it's not always coming from an apathetic choice like they're shrugging their shoulders. Sometimes it's kind of a paralyzing thing, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you know, that's the thing. I mean, when you can really come to terms with the fact that my mom was really doing the best she could, it also made it then possible for me to recognize that, you know, maybe I was doing the best I could as well. And maybe I had been holding myself to a standard that God wasn't even holding me to. This notion of needing to be perfect, this notion of never making mistakes, this notion that and if you do, there's always, you know, shame is always waiting for you. And eventually, if you make mistakes, you know, people are going to see this about you, that you are a mistake, and they're going to want to have nothing more to do with you. And so life becomes a mission of trying to make sure that you don't lose people by making sure that you don't make any mistakes when it comes to your relationship with them.
So you're playing not to lose rather than playing to win. Already feeling like, I mean, I'm talking about a person in general with some of this stuff underneath, feeling like they're already operating from a deficit. How often is that the case for people, would you say?
Susie, I think I have a job because this is the way we are. I mean, I think most of us relationally are often finding ourselves playing to keep from losing rather than playing to win. And we are either smothering people or we are running away from people because we are so terrified of real intimacy that leaves us in a place in which if we really are going to reveal who we are to someone but not clutch them, we have to, you know, we're going to run the risk that something might happen and they might leave. But therein lies, you know, being present with them without clutching, without running, is the only place where life is to be found. And that's what we see, I think, most prominently in the relationship that Jesus creates with the people that he surrounds himself with, and is a great model for us that we need to be following.
Think about that. Our tendency is to clutch or to run, and yet we heal in community, and I would submit that we also mature in community. I don't know how we can any other way. We're not made to go it alone. Talking to Dr. Curt Thompson today, Anatomy of the Soul is the name of his book. I have exactly one copy. I wish I had more for you. Email me for the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. We'll be back in a minute. Really glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is The Promise, talking to Dr. Curt Thompson. Such a fascinating conversation about his book, Anatomy of the Soul, surprising connections between neuroscience and spiritual practices that can transform your life and relationships. We've got one copy. Email if you want in on the drawing. You might be the person who wins. I hope you are. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget that mailing address. I would love, if you would, Dr. Curt, to talk about, just explain to us in layman's terms how both each of the sides of the brain, left and right side brain, works for, and why God wired us that way.
Well, it's a fascinating question, Susie. You know, I'll just put a plug in for another book, although our listeners would have to be really willing to dig in to read this. There's a book called The Master and His Emissary, and it is written by a British psychiatrist by the name of Ian McGilchrist, and it is 500 pages long. And he, in the first half of the book, he talks about the difference between the right and the left side of the book. But in the second half of the book, he talks about how culture is actually something that has been shaped by the way our right and our left hemispheres function, and how we have created a culture that is dominantly left hemispheric in its nature, which I'll get into in just a moment, but that asks us to behave in ways that really are not how we were made to behave. And I'll give us a couple of examples in just a moment. But, you know, when we are developing in the uterus, and in then the first few months of life, the right side of the brain, the right hemisphere, tends to develop and tends to be wired. So those neurons, those brain cells, are firing, connecting to each other far more efficiently than what is happening in the left brain. So the right brain tends to come online sooner than the left brain does. The left brain tends to come online more fully when a person is about 18 to 24 months of age. The right hemisphere, then, is the part of the brain that helps run most of a child's life in those first few months of life. And that includes things like visual spatial orientation, emotion, what we call holistic sensation of things. It's into our right hemisphere that we develop what we call an integrated map of the body. And by an integrated map of the body, we mean, you know, as you sense your body in time and space, your awareness of it as an adult, you don't think twice about that. You can sense, like, you feel your heart rate, you feel your stomach, you feel your arms, so forth and so on. But those are all things that we have to learn to have an integrated sense of. All of that stuff is taking place in the right hemisphere. Hence, so much of what we sense, what we image, what we feel, not just what we think, so much of what we sense, image, and feel is connected to our awareness of our body. All of that is taking place in the right hemisphere. Then, around 18 to 24 months of age, my left hemisphere starts to come online. And so my logical thinking, my linear thinking, my literal thinking all comes online primarily because my language system starts to wake up. So I produce words, and those words then become linear in their progression. Typically, I'll learn one word maybe by the time I'm a year old, and then two words by age two, and three words by age three, and we're talking in sentences, so forth and so on. And we have this logical, linear, and literal progression wherein which we like to say that we sense things that all come to our right hemisphere, and our right hemisphere sends what we sense to our left hemisphere to make sense of what we have sensed. And so there is this vast array of human experience that takes place via the right brain. So, for instance, someone comes in and you walk into a room and you immediately, without even having to scan it too much, you immediately either feel comfortable or not comfortable. That's a function of the right brain. You see someone's face and it lights up, and it lights up for you, and you recognize a felt sense of welcome. That's the right brain. When someone says to you, "Hey, that's a lovely pair of shoes you're wearing," when you're wearing a pair of old beat-up sneakers, because what they're doing is being playfully sarcastic, but because they're your friend, you get it. That's the right brain. We tend to get jokes. We tend to get all these different nuances. But the challenge is, my left brain likes order. My left brain likes things to be neat and tidy. My left brain likes to know that things are right or wrong. My left brain likes to keep things in line. And what this means is that we will sometimes end up sacrificing very important things that we sense, image, or feel in order to be right. And so, for instance, this happens in marriage all the time. I I don't know, in the last, probably happened within the last week with me, where one marriage partner says, well, last night in their art, in their conversation, well, I said this to you. And the other person said, no, you didn't. And they said, yes, I did. And what they're remembering that they said has more to do with the meaning of their words and not what they literally said. But the person who's listening is remembering what that person literally said. Now we're going to have a debate about what was said, and arguments start to emerge because somebody's right brain and somebody's left brain is not having the same conversation. And we've all been in those situations before. Bill comes home at the end of the day and says to his wife, gosh, you know, the guys at the office really liked my tie. And she is aghast because she can't believe he wore the tie. And she said, I can't believe that. And he said, well, they all said it was a really nice tie. But Bill might be someone who grew up in a family who, because they didn't pay much attention to emotion, Bill doesn't necessarily get the nuance of what people mean when they're being a little bit sarcastic. He just takes everything very, very literally. So we've all met people who can be a little obsessive. We've all met people for whom being right is far more crucial than paying attention to what people are feeling. And the hard part about that is that emotion or feeling is like the gasoline in the engine of a car. Emotion is the fuel that runs our human engine. And if I'm not paying attention to the way that is, that emotion is expressed by virtue of through my right brain, I then tend to interpret this through my left brain. And so if you're if it makes sense to me logically, then it's okay. And if it doesn't make sense to me logically, then it's not okay. What this then means culturally is that we end up doing a lot of things, including things like when we worship in church. Someone thinks that if we preach from the pulpit and we just explain things from the text logically and linearly, that somehow people will just get this and appropriate this and apply this to their life. But we remind them that when the common popular phrase, just say no to drugs, came out back in the 80s, the problem with that was that the part of our brain that hears the words, just say no to drugs, has got nothing to do with the part of our brain that does the drugs. And consequently, we think that just explaining things to people logically and linearly will be enough to get them to change their behavior, which of course it won't. And this, of course, shows up largely in parenting all the time.
So would you say, Dr. Kurt, if you've got somebody who overdepends on the left hemisphere, so really they miss the nonverbal cues in communication in relationships, and they think they're so right because they're so black and white that everybody else is missing it, where in fact maybe their sharp edges are actually scraping other people. Can that happen? Because when you're, I mean, I'm just wondering if as a child, maybe that the right side of the brain in those experiences that maybe there's miscues in relationships. So the culture for them makes them have to figure things out on the left side of the brain, thereby kind of warping their ability and capacity to process the right side. Is that, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but does that happen?
Yeah. Yes, you're absolutely right. You're saying it quite correctly. And, you know, I think about, I tell the one story in the book of the pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon who came to see me because he was not getting along well with his two-year-old. The surgeon's wife wanted, the surgeon wanted to have more children, and his wife was not going to have more children until he kind of worked out his parenting issues with their current two-year-old. And in the course of, and so this is a guy who was very bright, very kind, very smart. And a lot of his life, of course, was built around logical linear thinking, which of course you want your surgeons to be. But in the course of his exploring, you know, his life emotionally, we came to find out that he didn't really have a lot of access to a lot of deep emotion. And as we, you know, conducted his initial evaluation, we invited him to pay attention to his body. We invited him to, we have this little exercise that we do called a body scan. It doesn't involve any technology, but it merely is a way for people to, through the use of guided visual imagery, close their eyes and focus their concentration on what they actually sense and feel in their body. And when this gentleman began to pay attention to his abdomen, he noticed that he was starting to actually have some images come into his mind that he had not remembered in the course of the conversation that we had been having, where I had asked him a range of different questions about his family. And he said that his family was a lovely family growing up, a Christian family that talked about Jesus and he was saved and so forth and so on. And we asked if he had any particular losses or traumas, all of which he denied. But when we were doing the body scan and he began to have this memory, he then went on to relate that he was recalling being about 10 years of age and seeing himself standing in his driveway of his home and also seeing his mother and his two-year-old brother standing at the end of the driveway just before his brother bolted into the street and was hit and killed by a car.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, this
wow
was not something when we had gone through the psychiatric evaluation and asked him questions about have you had any losses, any traumas, he'd said no. And it wasn't as if he was not telling me the truth. He wasn't lying to me. But it's just that these things were not being brought to his mind because he had grown up in a family where emotion was not something people had paid much attention to. So he had not been invited to talk about what he felt, but he was an extraordinarily smart young man. And so consequently, the way that he began to regulate and take care of his life was through his intelligence, through his capacity to do well in school, using his left brain in a dominant way that enabled him to survive and flourish, in fact, but also at the expense of not paying attention to what he felt. And so through the work that we did, we began to invite him to pay attention to things that his body had been taking in, but from which he had been cut off. Consequently, we came to discover that this unresolved grief that he had for the loss of his two-year-old brother that he'd lost 26 years earlier was a big reason for why he was having trouble with his own two-year-old, because his own two-year-old was bringing back memory for him of what he had lost but what he had not grieved. And so this would be an example of how someone uses their left brain to be effective in the world, but also at the expense of not paying attention to what their right brain can possibly bring to the table. And then it then jeopardizes what you want to do going forward in other important relationships.
Wow, that's fascinating. When we come back, I'm going to ask you if what it looks like if a person overdepends on their right brain mode. And after that, we're going to talk about what it means to love the Lord our God with all of our minds and a few other just steps we can take to initiate growth and health in our life. These are listed in the book Aerobic Activity, Focused Attention Exercises, Novel Learning Experiences. We'll talk about all that and more with Dr. Kurt Thompson when we return. He is the King of the world, and we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and He loves us with an everlasting love. You hear me say this a lot if you tune in often enough, but that Jesus, when He looks at you, He doesn't roll His eyes. He doesn't breathe a heavy sigh. He loves you. He's committed to you. I'm so glad you tuned in. I'm talking to Dr. Kurt Thompson today about his book, Anatomy of the Soul, Surprising Connections Between Neuroscience and Spiritual Practices That Can Transform Your Life and Relationships. I feel like we're just getting started. I wish we had another whole hour with Dr. Kurt. We talked before the break about what happens when someone overdepends on the left hemisphere, the logical side. What does it look like when someone overdepends and functions out of the right side, kind of right brain, so to speak?
Yeah, it's we get, I think, in some respects, behavior that's quite the opposite. We find that in the same way that the left brain likes order, the right brain behaves in such a way that it doesn't really think about order much at all. And so we can have folks who are really living quite dominantly from their emotional experiences. And so whatever they happen to feel, that feeling may lead them to do something quite impulsively. So if they're feeling sad, they're not just feeling sad, their whole life is sad. And they move from sadness to joy, to grief, to anger, to what have you. And so what they, you know, their emotional states become perhaps sometimes the defining quality of who they are. And so it becomes more difficult for them to rein that in. And hence, being able to regulate that, control that in a way that can also create enough space for growing relationships can begin to take place. Now, this is what, you know, one of the things where we see this normally and naturally is when we have, you know, 18 to 36 month old children who have temper tantrums. Now, I have to say, we would probably be surprised if we saw an 18 to 36 year old person in the grocery store when they get upset about something, suddenly just fall down on the ground and start to scream at the top of their lungs. That would be unusual because we would expect that those folks have been able to learn how to rein in their right brain. But 18 to 36 month old children, their brains have not yet been able to learn how to do that. They've not learned how to restrain things in such a way that enables them to navigate in a healthy way. So those would be some of the things that we would sometimes see in folks whose right brains are really much more in charge of their life than would be healthy for them to be.
So that would that person be kind of use always never statements as far as things are as great as they've ever been, things are as terrible as they turn on a dime like that? Would that be an accurate description, just sort of living, as you say, from emotion to emotion?
Well, I think, you know, not everyone does. I think, you know, sometimes what, you know, in extreme cases, you can find that, you know, people, whatever they happen to be feeling at the moment becomes their own sense of how their life actually is in its totality.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, I'm feeling sad in the context of my life, which is actually really quite content and really quite rich, and I'll be okay in a little bit. But, you know, I'm happy to be sad at the moment. Whereas for some folks, their sadness becomes all consumptive, or even their joy becomes all consumptive in such a case where they're also not able to be sober enough to sense that you know that their good feelings are also not the complete expression and understanding of the nature of how their life actually is.
I would imagine that would be a tricky thing for the spouse because of big statements being made. You know, and I don't mean to laugh. I'm just saying that would feel like crazy making at times because versus keeping a context, everything is more broad and sweeping. Well, as you explained before the break on the left hemisphere, those who are overdependent on the left side maybe were denied the emotional processing of events. And so they go to the logical side. Conversely, what happens here typically in childhood that would compel someone to live out of that right-brained mentality?
Well, I think there are a couple things that can happen, and this is where I think work on studies in attachment, the attachment process, that process by which each one of us learn as newborns and infants to regulate ourselves by virtue of how we're reading the brains and the minds of our caregivers. And so in those attachment processes, if we grow up in settings in which, for instance, the adults who are taking care of us are not very mindful of our emotional states as little ones, but are simply they interact with us in response to their own internal state of affairs, then we can find that we don't really get the opportunity to learn how to regulate our emotions. So, for example, if mom is in distress, but the way she learns to regulate her distress is by interacting with her child, that now puts a lot of pressure on the child. So the child is playing quietly on the floor. Mom gets the stress. And despite the fact that it would be a better idea to just leave the child alone to play contentedly on the floor, mom interrupts the child because mom wants contact with the child to help mom feel better about mom. This startles the child, and this also means that the child begins to recognize that their own sense of boundaries, their own sense of emotional well-being can be, you know, those boundaries can be crossed at any given time. And so it becomes difficult for the child, you know, emotion is actually everywhere. It's all over the place. But the child doesn't really get the opportunity to learn how to regulate that. And so emotion is something that the child is always kind of swimming in. And then another thing that can happen is that when people have experiences with trauma, traumatic experiences, really, whether that's through you know, emotional or sexual or physical abuse, through neglect. There can be a range of different ways in which people's lives can be traumatized, wherein which the degree to which we experience emotional pain is not only severe and sharp, but it also takes place in a sense in which there's never any repair done. So I don't ever learn how it's possible to feel something strongly, but then have that repaired. And so in that sense, I can become flooded with a whole range of different feelings and never learn how to repair that. So in these two ways, wherein which one, parents aren't really paying attention to my mind, but are just responding to their own emotion by intruding into my life. And then on the other hand, where my experience can be one of trauma, those are two ways in which my life growing up is one in which emotion is flooding my system, and I never really get the opportunity to learn how to regulate that.
Wow, interesting. So, Dr. Kurt, we've got about 2 minutes before it's time to pray. So one last question. Great writer from the 1800s, famous dead guy, wish I could remember which one it was, but he said, we often make things hard by thinking them hard. And I thought that, you know, there's something to this, you know, that sometimes some will have a way of framing situations that consistently frame things in a negative light, where someone from the outside is looking in going, wow, I'd give anything to have your set of troubles. You actually have a pretty blessed life. I want you to talk about the power of the story we tell ourselves.
Right. Well, I think this is, it's a great question. And I would say, Susie, it may be one of the most important questions that we can explore. And that is this notion that we ask, now, what is the story in which we believe we're living? And we can all say, well, we believe we're living in the biblical narrative. Like we think we're in the time in between the first and second coming of Jesus. And we can say all that, but the reality is that I wake up tomorrow morning and I'm anxious as the day is long. I don't behave as if Jesus is in charge of my life, right? I tell myself a completely different kind of story. The challenge is that if, you know, with how we know the brain works with neuroplastic change, the more, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together, the more I tell myself a story the way that I tell it, the more this becomes the permanent story that is actually true for me, whether or not it's actually true in reality. This is why our interactions in community are so crucially important, because if I've told myself, like getting back to your opening question about my interaction with my mother, if my life story had been my mother had an option to choose something different and she didn't, if that's the story that I tell myself, that's going to have impact on me and my relationship with her and with others. If, however, someone starts to ask me questions, if I hear her story differently, it actually makes it possible for me to tell my story differently because I'm hearing her story differently. And that telling of the story differently begins with a shift in what I feel through an empathic connection with the other. And the good news of the gospel is that Emmanuel has come to find us, and in so doing, invites us to tell a very different story than the one we feel like not only we've been telling, but that we feel like we've had no choice but to tell that story and that one alone. Jesus has come to tell us something very different.
Boy, we're going to pray here. I pray you'll come back. Speaking of prayer, I want you to come back next month, because I feel like we're just scratching the surface. And Dr. Kurt, if you'd pray for that person who finds themselves framing their story in a way that other people find peculiar because they are blessed, but they've just retold a story that's been destructive to their soul. Would you pray?
Yes, indeed. God, our Father, we are grateful for time to explore your creation and the way that you've made us. And we pray for those listeners who have heard this today, who are longing for their lives to be different, who are longing for their lives to be joyful and full, and longing for a new story. And my hope is that you will bring people into their lives that will be that will enable them to tell their story differently, to tell their story in the way that we know that you long for it to be told, through the lens of the gospel and with the voice of Jesus, in whose name we pray.
Yes, Lord. Amen. Don't go away. Another great hour is coming up next. It's Talk to Me Thursday, and I want to know from you. Tell me three things you love about your life. A great hour up next. Back in a minute.